Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Dr. Matt Lauder. He is a senior lecturer in art history and theory and director of American Studies at the University of Essex. And we're talking about his book, Tattoos, The Untold History of a Modern Art. Matt, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
You write about a, quote, persistent amnesia about tattooing's history in the West. Why is that so?
I haven't fully figured out exactly why people keep forgetting. You know, I spent my life collecting headlines from newspapers which say, you never guess, tattooing's all the rage now, not just for sailors. You'll never guess, women are getting tattooed now. And the examples of that go right the way back to the late 19th century through the 1920s and 30s and, you know, almost every single decade. But I think, you know, one of the probably principal reasons is so much of tattooing is underneath clothing. People don't see a huge amount of the tattoos that have been performed. And certainly in history, you know, most of the tattooing that would have been done just wasn't shown off unless you were at the right, you got invited to the right parties, you know.
It's amazing because tattoos go back to prehistoric times. I mean, there are tattoos on bog people that they've pulled out of the sod.
Yeah, I mean, so actually, there's a story about that in my last book, actually. A lot of the bog tattoo history stories were made up by one German anthropologist who was
great,
falsifying his records. But
the tattoos were real, right? were the tattoos real?
No, so that's the bog stories is a sidetrack here, but it's a guy called Alfred Diep, who was an Austrian anthropologist, and he just basically invented loads of data about tattooed bog bodies, which was basically just not true at all, and discovered in the 90s by some grad students.
Okay, well,
invented it all.
Now this book concentrates on historical times, in Western Europe and in America. But even taking that narrow view, it's amazing how few written books there have been about tattoos. And you talk about them in the book. I mean, there are previous books like Tattoo, The Primitive Urge, never published.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the first book of its kind, depending on how you define it, since the 1950s, maybe since the 1930s. Books that really kind of are written with access to primary source material, with all the stuff that tattooers and their families keep secret, but also with a kind of sense of historical context and of, you know, exactly how these stories fit into bigger narratives of social and cultural life. So, I mean, I'm very lucky in a way to have a career, because if some of those books that I talk about in the beginning of my book had been published in the 70s, you know, I would have much less to do.
It's amazing the amount of photographs you have included in this book, but also the kinds of materials you had to dig into in order to find evidence of tattoos. Talk to me about where a lot of your information came from.
Yeah, well, I mean, most of the places that academics look for tattoos, you find really only criminals and sailors, right?
Right.
What we call surveilled populations. So places where bodies are recorded for posterity in official records. But to find a kind of more vernacular history, the history of sort of normal tattooed people, you have to look, I mean, really in lofts and attics and cupboards in some cases in my line of work. I mean, so much of it has been kept really by the community, by families of tattoo artists, by collectors. I mean, things literally have shown up in drawers of, you know, people have bought bits of furniture from auction houses, and the back of them there's a big envelope full of photographs, for example. So these stories are literally coming out of the woodwork. And one of the things I've been able to do, because I've been getting tattooed for a long time and I was a tattoo collector, tattoo fan before I was a historian, is that, you know, people would show me things that they wouldn't show a dustier professor who'd show up and say, hey, I think you're weird, show me your gear. So I mean, this book is a product really, in some sense, of 20 years of traveling the world and asking people to roll up their sleeves and open up their drawers.
What was amazing to me is that some of your sources were old prints and paintings. And you really have to be looking for the tattoos in order to see them. You wouldn't notice them most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, particularly when we get back to the really early days of Western tattooing, so early modern period, 17th century, there really aren't that many images, actually, of tattooed Europeans, mainly because, though there were tattooed European people around, most of the tattooing would have been under clothing, and, of course, people weren't generally rolling up their sleeves for their official portraits. And then, even in some pictures, the tattoos have faded away, or, as you said, they're not particularly visible. And again, a lot of this stuff was just sort of sitting there waiting to be spotted. I mean, I talk in the book early on about William Hogarth, very famous painter and printmaker of Georgian England. And there's a tattooed woman in one of his most famous scenes, the Rake's Progress, a woman with a tattoo on her breast, which has been mentioned by scholars, but hadn't been sort of put into historical context, such that, you know, there were people who were saying, oh, tattooing was discovered in the Pacific in the 1770s, even though a couple of decades earlier, Hogarth was documenting it in Georgia, London.
Let's talk about this, because before the opening of Japan, who was getting tattooed and by whom?
Yeah, so really the best records we have are of Christian pilgrims. And in fact, the earliest tattooer that I found working in England was a guy sort of doing knockoff pilgrimage tattoos. So a lot of Europeans were getting tattooed in Jerusalem.
So was this sort of to mark your pilgrimage?
Yeah, I mean, sort of a cross between a devotional mark and a sort of souvenir of your holiday.
Wow.
And I sort of compare it to getting a drunk tattoo. You know, maybe people go to Tijuana and have a spring break tattoo. It's sort of the 17th century version of that. I mean, the technology for that goes back to the 16th century in Italy, where people are realizing you can make religious marks on the body. And it becomes a really important part of pilgrimage culture starting in the late 1500s. We have quite a lot of records of that, of Brits and Germans and Frenchmen and Dutchmen and all kinds of people, with a practice that continues to the present day. But yeah, as early as 1719, there's a housebreaker who's arrested in London, and he tells the arresting officer that his business is making the Jerusalem mark. So if he didn't have the time or the inclination as a wealthy gentleman traveler to go to Nazareth or Bethlehem or Jerusalem, some guy down the pub could knock you one off for a few pence.
Well, and what I learned in your book is criminals who had tattoos, those were registered with the police as part of their description.
Yeah, so one of the reasons, actually, that, tattooing becomes of interest to criminology is because there's lots of tattooing happening, and criminologists in the middle of the 19th century believe that they can read your bad criminal character on your skin, and tattoos become a kind of indicator of just how bad a person you are. And so when you get checked into prison, you know, in the days before fingerprinting and certainly before DNA testing and things like that, tattoos became a useful way of figuring out who's who. And the same in the Navy. So, you know, if you were press ganged and you ran away and you were recaptured, check if you were the person that they thought you were based on the tattoos. Or actually, if you died at sea and your body washed up at the beach, you know, tattoos could be a useful record of identity.
Now, at this time, there are no, like, as we're used to today, tattoo studios, salons, or parlors. So,
no.
How did you find a place to get a tattoo?
Well, I think so. Before the middle of the 19th century, tattooing in Europe, at least, would have been basically between pals, right? It would have been in intimate settings, in the army, in the navy, in boarding schools. We get professional tattooing basically when rich people want to get tattooed. So, starting in the late 1850s, as you alluded to, after the opening of Japan, when rich people want to take up this new trend, it begins to be possible to charge money as a professional tattoo artist. The first guy we have is a guy in records of is a guy in New York called Martin Hildebrandt, starting in the late 1850s. And then as early as 1871, even in Philadelphia, there's a beautiful article in the National Police Gazette of an unnamed Polish woman tattooing sort of demi-monde and fancy women in her well-appointed salon downtown in Philadelphia somewhere. So very, very quickly, the sort of desire of wealthy people to treat tattooing as a commodity turns it into, you know, what we recognize today as a tattoo trade, I guess.
I'm sure a lot of people are wanting to know, what were they using both for the instrument to make the mark, and then what are they using for the inks?
Yeah.
Originally. Well, I mean, I know what they're doing now, but...
Yeah, well, in strange way, not much has changed. I mean, really, all you need to make a tattoo is something sharp and some pigment. And even back in prehistory, back, you know, 5,500 years ago, that was a sharp needle and some carbon black from a fire, for example, in many cases. And in this professional era, tattooers are repurposing sewing needles, for example, lashing them together with some cotton onto a short-handled stick. And then for ink, using essentially Indian ink. And as the professional era goes on into the 1880s and 90s, they start experimenting with really artists' pigments. I mean, sort of standard things, powdered pigments that artists of other media are mixing into paints. And some of that goes quite well and turns out, you know, to produce nice work. Some of it is horribly, horribly toxic and doesn't feel in the body.
Jesus.
It was really difficult to find a yellow pigment, for example. If you know that in 19th century, powdered pigmented yellow is usually cadmium lead.
Yeah.
So people, that didn't tend to heal very well in the body and caused a lot of the early experimenters a lot of problems.
Now, what about motifs?
Yeah.
What about motifs? In your book, they start off fairly basic, like the ones like you would imagine a sailor would have on. What was the effect of... You write about this, and this is why I find this book so fascinating, because you bring in so many other sort of strings to this picture. What were the effects of the Pacific voyages of Captain James Cook and Bougainville in the late 1700s? I mean, they were coming across cultures that tattooing had a long-standing tradition in. Did that knowledge come back to the public in Western Europe?
Yeah, so for a long time... this amnesia about tattooing basically said that it, you know, started in the Pacific, that there was no tattooing before the late 18th century, or if people did acknowledge those pilgrimage histories that were 200 or 300 years older than that, they would say, well, you know, people forgot about that stuff, and all of a sudden European sailors wanted to copy the Maori and people in Tahiti and Fiji and stuff. But actually, if you look at the records, really sort of nothing happens. The things that people are tattooing immediately before and immediately after are very basic icons that are found in the life world of the sailor and the soldier of that period. So pierced hearts and religious symbology and stars and anchors and names are very frequent as well. Names either their own names for identity purposes or names of lovers and family members. And sort of counter to that sort of standard idea of the Pacific encounter, like, unless you were very, very wealthy and very, very well traveled, someone like Joseph Banks, for example, who was a very famous botanist. He was Cook's chief scientific officer. He was tattooed in Samoa, for example. And a couple of guys, most famously the Mutiny on the Bounty, went rogue and ended up living amongst the islanders of the Pacific and ended up with some more Pacific-style things. But actually, nothing much changes. And then, you know, when the professional era happens, there is this, again, kind of almost artistic development happening very quickly, partly driven, as I said, by Japan. Japan's opened up to the West in the late 1850s, and Europeans want Japanese-style tattoos. But then, of course, as today, right, people get tattooed on them, the images that are around them. So the first real big-name professional tattoo artist in London, a guy called Sutherland and MacDonald in the 1880s and 90s, most of his clients, who were members of the House of Lords and various wealthy members of high society, they were getting either, you know, very trendy French salon pictures, or they were getting hunting, shooting, fishing prints, the kind of things that they'd have on the walls of their country houses, you know, scenes of peregrine falcons and duck hunts and things like that.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Dr. Matt Lauder. He's a senior lecturer in art history and theory and director of American Studies at the University of Essex. And we're talking about his book, Tattoos, The Untold History of a Modern Art. Talk to me about, when did the first electric tattoo tattooing device come about?
Yeah, so with this professionalization and this sort of demand, all of a sudden there's money, and of course time is money, and so this is also the period, of course, of great rapid inventions and development in Victorian Europe and America, and of course, so that means there's lots of interesting devices that make electromagnet go up and down. So one of them is what's called a dental plugger. Was the first ever patented handheld electric device, basically for drilling your teeth. And American tattoo artists in New York adapted that very quickly to tattooing. And then competitors started finding other things they could adapt. So doorbells became a source, for example. If you imagine the mechanism inside an old-fashioned doorbell, it is just basically an electromagnet that makes an armature bar go up and down very, very quickly. And then in England, the device that was adapted was an invention by Thomas Edison that he'd made for basically printing or piercing holes in documents. It was a destructive copying technique, basically. You could kind of run this rotating needle arm over a document, create punctures, which you could then print copies through. And that was adapted for a tattoo machine in about 1891. So one of the stories really that sort of runs through the whole book is that the tattooing industry and the tattooing culture is really driven by commercial demands, right? Because the more tattoos you can do in a day, the quicker it is, the more money you can make.
Now, these tattoo parlors, were they considered to be respectable sort of businesses?
Yeah, it depends, right? So, for example, that first spot in New York was on by the docks on Oak Street, and was inside a saloon, so probably not very salubrious. But
what a great location for all the people that are piling on the drinks.
Busy. Yeah, very busy and lots of things coming through. But the first tattoo sort of studio in London was inside the Hammam Turkish Bath on Jermyn Street. So Jermyn Street's a very fancy area of the west of London, still to this day an area of high-end tailoring and art galleries and things like that. And so actually you had this sort of market segmentation, really. There'd be guys that were working in very, very posh areas of town, particularly in England, to cater to the wealthier client, and then you'd have kind of a middle-class clientele, and then you'd have your lower-class clientele, maybe who are getting tattooed by traveling tattooers or at fairgrounds.
There was also people like David Purdy, who wrote a how-to book and sort of encouraging people to do it themselves. It was how to tattoo, what to use, and how to use them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, like entrepreneurialism, really. So many grifters, so many people kind of seeking a buck. And one of the ways you could make a nice living as alongside tattooing is to sell your equipment to other people and sell your secrets, sell your designs, sell your kits. And Purdy was a real mystery to me. No one had really heard much about him, but he did publish this beautiful little How to Tattoo book. But in the research for the book, I discovered really that he may have tattooed. He certainly did tattoo, really. But his main job was a postman, and a lot of the claims he makes in that book are certainly overblown. And in fact, he lived with a printing ink manufacturer, so it may have been a little bit of a side hustle for the printing ink manufacturer to get rid of excess stock. But you could. I think it's interesting to people who imagine that tattooing was always underground secret world, that in the late 1890s through to the really World War One, tattooing was, if you wanted to be a tattooer, you could just mail order a tattoo kit and instructions and crack on. Tattoo machines were also even available for a while from a department store in London called Gammage's as electrical novelties. So around about 1911, 1912, you could just walk in off the street. Not particularly cheaply, to be fair, but you could just buy over the counter, just as you would buy any other kind of consumer device, a tattoo machine, which I think is surprising. It was surprising to me when I learned that many years ago, but I think it's surprising to people today.
I want you to talk about flash. It's a word I knew what it referred to, but I never knew that word, flash.
Yeah, I mean, people. So flash is designed, like if you go into a tattoo shop, imagine the archetypal tattoo shop in your mind. It's the designs that are sort of there on the wall for you to pick. And I think people imagine that that word is flash, as in quick, that you can kind of come in and get the tattoo quickly. But it actually comes from flash in the sense of flashy, showing off. And it's originally was a bookmaker's term in the 1920s and 30s, turf accountant. So you go down and all the bookmakers at the race course, the racetrack, would have all of their prices up, painted in beautiful banners to attract the punters in. And so tattooers began to do that as business boomed, really, and competition boomed. Having the best designs, having the most colorful banners, yeah, having the most bright window display was a way to get people in. Also, mass production of flash, which begins in the 1920s as well, is a way that if you can't draw, you can still be a tattoo artist. And in fact, some American entrepreneurs, including a guy called Milton Zeiss from Rockford, Illinois, really realized that mass production flash would be a great business, because you could just sell, alongside machines and needles and how-to guides, everything you need to start tattooing, even if you couldn't draw a straight line, you know.
Wow. That's absolutely amazing. You also write about how different historical incidents like wars affected the themes of the tattoos. Like World War One had an effect on who got tattooed and the designs. Talk about that.
So World War One is really interesting, because it's a way of bringing people to, you know, all these people all of a sudden brought together. And tattooing is really interesting because you can't lose it. It can't be stolen. So people want to take things with them from home, but, you know, your watch or your locket or something risks being stolen or discarded. So tattoos become really important in wartime as ways of memorializing home. They're also ways, actually, of course, for people in uniform to paradoxically perhaps become individual. So we're all the same in uniform, but we all look different outside of uniform if we have our tattoos. But also, of course, like, you're thrown together in a regiment or a unit with people with whom you have nothing in common, particularly during World War One. And tattooing allows a kind of very quick sense of fraternity, right? You can create, and we see this in, you know, frat houses and in professional sports teams as well to this day, where tattooing allows people paradoxically to be sort of separate, individual, and also create a group identity. And, you know, the nice thing about tattooing in wartime is that it's a way of you know, engaging with the visual culture of the period. So all of a sudden we have the traditional sailing ship tattoo, maybe, for example, becomes the Iron Hulk, or the tank tattoo becomes a thing, because tattooing, as Milton Zeiss himself said, you know, is as ancient as time and as modern as tomorrow. So the practice is thousands of years old, but the designs are always going to be cutting edge.
What's weird, the flappers became really passionate about tattoos. But then with World War II, and maybe before too, some tattoo parlors also offered facial remodeling.
Yeah. Again, I think people imagine that kind of things like permanent makeup and microblading and things like that are quite new, but it's a very good sideline. You know, when you've tattooed the husband, you can do some cheek rouging and some lip tattooing and some eyebrows on their mother and wife and daughter as well. And a lot of the high-end tattooers, both in London and in New York and San Francisco and elsewhere in the world, were having a sideline in you know, what we might call now permanent makeup. It certainly wasn't as subtle and as, you know, you'd be very brave getting your cheeks rouged by a Victorian tattooer. But many of these guys did have separate studios in nicer parts of town, specifically to cater. And you know, some of them even took on sort of pseudonyms, actually, to specifically cater to that kind of beauty culture crowd. And of course, again, the 1920s is a really important moment for beauty culture in general. It's a good way of making a bit of extra money, a bit of extra, again, that kind of hustle that I think is really interesting.
We only have a few minutes left, but with the 20th century comes stories of individual tattoo artists. And so you get to know the artists behind the tattoo more in the 20th century, obviously. But I just want to mention one couple, Samuel Deffy Grossman and Edith Stella Grossman, you describe as the power couple of tattooing.
Yeah, Stella and Duffy, this great kind of husband and wife performing couple who always, you know, looked sharp and mixed tattooing with their acts, you know, going around the United States tattooing visitors. And I think one of the things I had real trouble with, real fun with, was trying to make sense of these timelines and who were the key names. And it ends up, quite surprisingly, being a very small number of people, particularly in the post-war period, actually, particularly in the 1950s and 60s, comes a small number of people who are responsible for the tattoo world that we have today.
It's so radically different when I look at contemporary tattoos, where entire scenes are done in multiple colors over huge areas, like over the back and down the legs. It's breathtaking comparing it to those original ones from like just 100 years before.
Yeah. I mean, there were a few people doing those big back pieces in the 19th century, but they were very rare and also very expensive. I mean, if you were getting a whole back piece done in the 1890s, it was going to cost you a lot of money. But now, of course, as you said, the culture of tattooing, and particularly the culture of really sort of showing off more skin in public, I think, has allowed people to really kind of use that canvas in a much more expansive way. My back was my last big unfinished spot, so I spent 7 hours getting my own back tattooed the other day. So solidarity with all those people in whose bed I follow.
We're completely out of time, and there's so much more in this book. My guest tonight has been Dr. Matt Lauder. He's a senior lecturer in art history and theory and director of American Studies at the University of Essex. In his book, I strongly recommend it, Tattoos, The Untold History of a Modern Art. Matt, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.